Birthday parties going full blast next door. Fireworks, hot dogs, the whole thing. And we shut the curtains and decided to talk about a glass theater in Brisbane instead. Why does that feel like the most patriotic thing we could do?
You know, that's an interesting way to put it. And it sort of gets right to the heart of what Jürgen, the curator, was thinking for this issue. He's a naturalized citizen, you know, sworn in way back in 1990 during, get this, the John Gotti mob trial in a Brooklyn courthouse. And his view, I mean, his whole take is that earned patriotism, it's like totally compatible with looking everywhere else for inspiration. So for issue number 82, it's really a celebration of that idea. There are zero American stories in it on purpose.
So it's almost like, you know, because he chose this place, he's earned the right to look outward on its birthday. I kind of like that. So what kind of outward are we looking at here?
Well, we're going quite a few places. We're going to check out, you know, a theater in Brisbane that actually ripples like water, which is just kind of incredible to think about. And we'll also look at Bjork, not just as a singer, but as an artist who just really refuses to stay in any one medium. And then there's a Norwegian artist who built her own crystal radio to turn the northern lights into sound. We'll also see some really poignant photos of extinct birds taken so tenderly they sort of seem to breathe. And finally, Jenny Holzer, you know, staging American political resistance, but she's doing it in Portugal. So quite a tour, all in issue number 82. There's a show in Reykjavik right now where Bjork is hung on a gallery wall, not as a singer who just, you know, dabbles in other stuff, but as a painter and video artist and musician all at once. Like the song was never just the point and was never not the point, if that makes sense.
That's interesting. So it's not like she also does video or she also does fashion. It's all kind of part of the same expression.
Exactly. I mean, Craig McLean's piece for Wallpaper really goes through this. He talks about these two exhibitions at the National Gallery of Iceland, celebrating the like deeply multifaceted nature of Bjork's creativity. The whole framing is that everything, you know, sort of radiates out from the songs and absolutely nothing stays in its lane.
Like the outfit is the same idea as the sound, or the visual is, it's not just a music video, it's something more.
Yeah, precisely. The wardrobe choices, the instruments, even the visuals built to sit alongside the sound. They're not just, you know, decoration around the music. They're, I guess you could say they're the same idea, just wearing different clothes. And as the quote puts it, the National Gallery of Iceland celebrates the multifaceted nature of Bjork's creativity with two exhibitions. Most of us, we treat our disciplines like rooms with doors, right? Bjork just knocked the walls down decades ago, and then, like, she just kept rearranging the furniture, which, you know, is harder and stranger than it sounds. It makes me wonder, when a song stops being only a song, I mean, where does the artwork begin?
That's a good question. I mean, Jürgen, the curator, he mentioned he's pretty, you know, happy to own that Bjork's music isn't for everyone. He's cool with that. But what he really loves is that the show just refuses to separate those parts.
Right. For him, the interconnected quality is the work. Like, it's the thing that most so-called multidisciplinary artists only kind of gesture at or, you know, try to approximate. But with her, it's just so organic and it just works. It's all just one big, you know, creative statement.
Yeah, it's not just an album with a really cool video. It's like the album and the video and the costume and the whole presentation is all part of the art itself.
Yeah, and I think that's what makes it so interesting to, you know, look at from this perspective.
Before we keep crossing borders, quick word about how this whole thing keeps running. The reason this newsletter can, you know, point the camera at Reykjavik and Brisbane and Porto and like a Norwegian fjord all in a single week is that it's actually curated by a working artist technologist. It's not some algorithm just chasing clicks. If you're looking for a steady feed of art and tech stories with substance instead of just type, you should really subscribe. You can find it at theintersect.art.
Okay, back out into the world.
Next one's from a fjord.
So I went in wanting to love this one. I really did. And I came out kind of admiring it more than enjoying it, which is a weird place to land.
Yeah, I know that feeling. You're talking about Marta Zapparulli's album, Interdimensional Generated Space, right? I saw that piece in Neural Magazine.
That's the one. And it's like the concept is so, so good. She's got these field recordings captured up in Norway, and she weaves them together with these studio sessions. And get this, she's using a self-built crystal radio, light detectors, motors, antennas, all this gear to transpose the aurora borealis into sound.
Which, I mean, that's just a wild ambition, to take something as visually overwhelming and, you know, just immense as the Northern Lights and turn it into something audible. It was released on Disapasio, that Italian experimental label run by Nicola Curaconi. It really sits at this interesting intersection of natural phenomenon and really deliberate technological mediation.
Right? And Neural's review, it really captures it by saying the piece exploits the contrasts between invisible processes and sensory perceptions, creating an unprecedented experience of space, time, and human scale. I mean, that sounds, everything about that sounds really compelling.
Conceptually, it absolutely is. The idea of like these invisible processes made perceptible, that's what we talk about so much. But then you listen to it and it's, well, it's interesting in the way a physics lecture can be interesting. It's intellectually rich, but it kind of keeps you at arm's length experientially. It's not something you'd just sort of put on in the background.
Exactly. Like, I respect it so much, the sheer effort, the ingenuity of building your own gear to achieve this. It's really something to admire. But then when you actually put the headphones on, it's just a bit thin, you know?
I think the curator had a similar honest read on it, actually. Jürgen mentioned he loved the idea here more than the actual listening experience. He said he pulled it up on Bandcamp with real anticipation, and what came back was fine, not unpleasant, but not something he'd put on while cooking dinner. The thought of using self-built radios and all that to make soundscapes from the Northern Lights is incredibly appealing. But to his ear, well, not that pleasant to listen to.
Yeah, that totally resonates with my experience. So it leaves you with this kind of question, right? Like, does that gap between a compelling concept and a compelling experience, does that matter? Or does documenting the attempt, the whole intricate process, the entire point of the artwork itself?
That's a good question to sit with.
Speaking of tech you can barely hear, wait until you see one where you can barely see the tech at all. If the last one was tech you can hear but can't really see the point of, this next one's like the total opposite. There's like no algorithm anywhere in it, and yet it really couldn't have existed 20 years ago, I don't think.
Right, I know what you mean. This is Fiona Partington's Tahariki Skyside. It's the Aotearoa New Zealand Pavilion for the Venice Art Biennale in 2026. And the thing is, she's working with her collaborator, Neil Partington, photographing these taxidermy birds. They're like extinct birds, the huya, the laughing owl, some species that are still just barely hanging on.
And she's pulling them, I guess, from museum collections, right? And the way she lights them, it's so tender. They almost seem to breathe. I mean, you look at them and you kind of forget they're not, you know, alive. It's really quite something.
Yeah, it takes these endangered specimens and turns them into portraits. And it really brings in all these different layers, colonial collecting, ecological loss, and, you know, Maori understandings of Manu as spiritual messengers. All of that sort of sits inside the same frame. And the tech, it's there, but it's really quiet. It's large-scale printing, it's very soft lighting, very patient post-processing. And you see it in the way that Tomai Timpu's piece in Design Boom puts it. Signs of taxidermic repair, stitched feathers, and worn surfaces remain visible in the photographs, acknowledging the fragility of the specimens and the histories attached to them.
Yeah, those visible stitches. I mean, that's what sort of grabbed me. It's like proof someone really did try to preserve what was already, you know, pretty much lost. And the camera, it chose to show those seams rather than trying to hide them. It just, it makes you stop and you know, look a little closer.
And that's the thing. When did we decide technology and art actually has to look like technology to count? I mean, this doesn't shout its process at you at all. It just serves the subject so beautifully.
It's kind of, I don't know, it's a slightly contrarian pick for a newsletter that lives at the art and machines intersection, isn't it? I mean, Jürgen mentioned that for him, it's that there isn't an algorithm in sight, and that's sort of the point.
Yeah, he said it's a poignant, deliberately non-AI use of photography. But still, it uses what you could call quiet tech, right? Large-scale printing, that soft lighting, the post-processing that just, you know, wouldn't have been easy or even possible in the past. It's tech that serves the subject instead of announcing itself.
Different story now, but it pulls on that exact thread. Tech that disappears so the art can show up. If you build a tool that makes a whole new kind of building thinkable for the first time, who actually gets to claim the idea? The architect or the engineer?
That's a really good question to kick off like this next piece. We're talking about the Glasshouse Theater in Brisbane. It's an extension of the Queensland Performance Center, which is a big brutalist structure. And the design, it's by Blight Rayner Architecture with Snohetta. It actually nods to a prose poem by a Moree artist, Lilla Watson, about the Brisbane River and the fish moving beneath it.
So it's got this really cool rippling facade, right? Like it looks almost liquid. How do they do that with glass, you know?
Well, that's where the tech bit really comes in. The rippling facade leans really heavily on this curved glass technology from a Chinese manufacturer, North Glass. They can bend these 7-meter panels, and the kicker is they keep them optically clean, like no warping, no visible stress lines. It's pretty wild, honestly.
That's sort of what we were talking about before with like the tech kind of disappearing, right? The river ripples, but the engineering, the actual machinery behind it, it just sort of vanishes.
Exactly. I mean, the way they describe it is by reducing visible stress patterns and improving reflection clarity, the process lets the sky, street life, and movement outside read more continuously across the wave-like glass facade. It makes it all feel so fluid. So like the best technical work, it's really the work you can't see.
It's interesting, though. You know, Jürgen, he actually snagged on something here, like about the word vision.
Yeah, he really does love it when technology bends toward the arts, and he absolutely counts architecture as art. But he keeps kind of snagging on this idea of vision. We often talk like the artist had this perfect vision first, and then the tools just caught up or, you know, they helped execute it. But he thinks that sometimes it runs the other way.
Like the curved glass shows up and suddenly a vision becomes thinkable that wasn't, you know, an option before.
Precisely. The capability, the new tool, it shapes the imagination. It's not just the execution. So it's like, who claims the idea then? Was it the architect who drew the ripple or the engineer and the manufacturer who made the ripple possible in the first place? It's a really good tension there. And he did mention he'd happily fly to Queensland just to stand in front of it.
Wow. Last one. And it's the only piece in the whole issue aimed straight back at America, except, of course, it's hanging in Portugal. Picture a golden canvas, but it's hung upside down on a Porto gallery wall. And then there's spinning LED text, you know, crawling across the room, some stone carvings, those really acid-bright posters we know from her. And, well, a face on the wall that looks suspiciously like a certain 45th and then 47th president.
Right. I mean, that's Jenny Holzer in full effect, isn't it? It's her first solo show in Portugal, actually, at the Serralves Museum there. And Annalise Kamigawa's piece in Design Boom really lays it out. She brings her whole kit, those spinning LED works, the stone carvings, the inflammatory essays, and she just points all of it straight at the current American political moment.
And the upside-down golden canvas, that's a reference to the note, I guess, that Trump received on January 6th, right? I mean, subtle, she is absolutely not.
Oh, not at all. And it's interesting, there's a collaborative edge to it, too. Holzer working with graffiti and urban artists, so the language kind of spills onto surfaces the way, you know, posters once colored 70s New York. And there's this quote in the piece, "Change is the basis of all history, the proof of vigor." It makes you think about language itself, doesn't it?
Like, we don't usually think of words as technology, but watching Holzer stage them through neon and LED and stone, the sentence might be old, but the apparatus carrying it isn't. And that apparatus, it changes how the sentence actually lands. It's like, when does a word stop being a word and start becoming a machine for moving people?
Exactly. And Jürgen, the curator, he mentioned a real-world tie here, too. He's actually working with a client, Arterial, on an upcoming exhibition called Resistance. And this Holzer piece, I mean, it would have just slotted in perfectly. He also, he really enjoys the irony of an American artist staging her resistance abroad, you know, in Portugal.
I love that. It's like you're critiquing home from outside.
Yeah, and what pulls him in most, he said, is that collaborative kind of street art rooted side of it, plus just the tech as staging of written language, the power of it.
Okay, let's close it out. So, 5 dispatches from everywhere but home, right? On the day home turns 250. It's a kind of interesting thought to end on, I guess.
Yeah, I mean, it really comes back to that question we started with, doesn't it? Like, does great work require leaving home? Or, I don't know, maybe it requires knowing exactly where home is so you can leave it on purpose.
It certainly feels like that for a lot of these projects, for all of them, actually.
If you want more stories like these, you know, stuff with substance, not just hype, you can find the entire issue, issue number 82, along with all the past issues, and subscribe at theintersect.art.
Thanks for listening.